Welcome everyone to our next installment of the Kollel Aharon Velea class series, The Sixth Sense. Tonight we're going to explore something on the feminine side. We've all heard of women's intuition. So in the Torah, there's another word for women's intuition, which is much more profound. It's called Bina Yetera, an extra set of understanding that women have perhaps uniquely, an ability to see what is there even when it's not there. So I remember growing up as a little boy, and my ima, my mom, a blessed memory, would very often tell us, you know, this is the way it's going to be. And we would say, ima, mom, how do you know? And she would just say, I know, trust me. And if we dare not trust her, inevitably, we live to regret it. Jeffrey, I have a source sheet for you right up here, if you'd like. Thank you. Welcome, welcome. And I happen to know from my years of lovely marriage to Rachel, she sometimes will rebuke me because I dare not listen to her, but I always regret it. And every male has always had this, okay? You ask the guys if this is, if they don't admit this, they're lying, okay? But either with mom or with their sister or with their wife or their daughter, they've had experiences where they've gone and they've said, okay, what do you think about XYZ? And the lady of our lives will say, either yay, it's great, wonderful, go ahead. Or they'll say, be very, very careful. You're going to get burned. Or it's going to end in a unfriendly way for you. Cease and desist. And if the guys persist and don't cease and desist, they live to regret it. But the best is when you ask the lady of your choice, can you please help me to understand why are you opposed to this? Why do you think this is going to end badly? And then they have the delightful answer, I don't know, but I just know it's not going to end your way, but I can't quantify it for you. So the rabbis explained that men predominantly use a sort of intellectual process for things that are readily apparent and objectively real, and we use a lot of sort of, and that doesn't mean that women don't use this process, but men, by and large, use this sort of process of deduction and reason, and it has to sort of add up. Whereas women, in addition to being able to reason something that is linear, they're also able, uniquely, not every time, and not every woman in every case, but a unique gift that God gave women is this bina yetera, this sort of sixth sense to be able to tap into things that are not objectively apparent, and maybe they can't even quantify why they say it. They just have a gut feel. They just know that this is the way it is. Be very, very careful. So we see this in the most magnificent way, but very understandable and explainable in our first source. Our parsha, our Torah reading this last week, was Korach. So just to give you a very quick background about Korach, Korach was a cousin of Moses and Aaron. But he was aggrieved. Why? Because he's a Levite, but he was passed over for leadership within the Jewish people. Aaron is the de facto priest, the high priest, the Kohen Gadol. Moses is the Melech, the unofficial king of the Jews, etc., etc. What about me? So Korach, rather than come out and say, hey, it's about me, he tried to pretend I'm a man of the people. And all the Jewish people, kulam kedoshim, we're all holy, and we don't need leaders. Except, wink, wink, I want to be Moses, and I want to be Aaron. But he didn't tell anybody this. That was his little agenda. So at the beginning of our story, literally the opening pasuk, the opening verse of the parsha, look at source one. Korach, the son of Yitzhar, the son of Kahat, the son of Levi, so he comes right from Levite direct ancestry, took himself to one side, along with Datan and Aviram, who were the sons of Eliav, and On, the son of Pelet, all who were descendants of Reuven. So what happened? Korach assembled a rabble. We call them Adat Korach, the company, the congregation of Korach. And what did he do? He fomented rebellion against Moses and Aaron and ultimately, of course, God. And he pretended, as we said, to be a man of the people. We're all holy. We don't need Moses and Aaron. And wink, wink, I'm going to be the new Moses and Aaron. Come with me. Now, we know Datan and Aviram, they've been adversaries and thorns in the side of Moses all the way back to Egypt land. Remember, they were the ones who informed on Moses when he killed the Egyptian taskmaster. And if you remember the movie, I mean, I'm sorry, but any time you're portrayed by Edward G. Robinson in the movie The Ten Commandments, you're not a likable, happy-go-lucky guy. Where's your God now, Moses? Billy Crystal, by the way, did a very good shtick. He said, you know, when you're casting biblical films, there are certain actors who should never get parts. Edward G. Robinson, you know, it's a giveaway, right? So Datan and Aviram, they were always aggrieved. Everything Moses did, they were anti. But who? What about this character, On Ben Pelet? He only appears in the Torah once, in this verse right here. He didn't die. He is not mentioned as those who unfortunately lost their lives because they participated in Korah's rebellion. So I know I've shared this with you in the past, but if you heard it, it's great. If you haven't, it's even better. Okay, so here's the story. On Ben Pelet didn't die because he listened to his wife. So what happened? So On throws his lot in with Korah, yeah? And he comes home for dinner, I guess, and Mrs. On Ben Pelet, we don't know her name even, this remarkable woman, says, dear, why are you going against the word of God and siding with Korah against Moses and Aaron? So he's thinking about it. He's not maybe the sharpest knife in the drawer. I don't know. But he says, well, you know, I committed myself to this. But dear, have you thought this through? Clearly he had not. She said, well, look, play a little game with me. Okay, let's use your male logic that you like so much, right? Linear logic, okay? If Korah wins, he becomes Moses and Aaron. You, my dear husband, your station does not change. You don't have anything to gain. You'll just be who you are, one of the leaders of the tribe of Reuben. See, you won't gain. But if Korah and you lose, you're dead. So why are you with this insane proposition? So On's thinking about it, and he, to his credit, he hears his wife's logic, her insight. He says, but you know, I committed myself. They're going to be coming to get me any day, any moment now. I want to be part of the thing. I can't get out of it. I can't back out. I gave my word. My dear, this is where it gets delicious. She says, I'll get you a nice meal. I'll serve you some nice fortified wine. You'll go to sleep, and I'll take care of the rest, yeah? Leave it in my hands. So what does she do? She gives him a nice meal. She gives him very powerful fortified wine, and he's sleeping off his hangover in the tent. So what does she do? She, On, Ben Pelet's wife, takes her shaitel, her head covering off, and she sits outside the tent, and she takes her brush, and she starts, you know, the thousand strokes of the hair. And when the men who are sent by Korah, because he's upset, where's On? He's one of my powerful confidants and members of my team. He's not coming. So he sends, you know, emissaries, shlichim, to come get him. So they're coming down the rise, and they look up, and there's a woman, a married woman, with her hair exposed. Ooh. So they're like this, you know, they can't look at a woman's hair. So it's okay, by the way, to rebel against God and Moses. That they're not too upset about. But to see a married woman's hair, they, you know, you got to draw the line somewhere, right? So they're like, ah! I'm making fun of them because they're idiots. So these two, the emissaries come over the rise. They see Mrs. On there with her hair exposed. And they're like this. They can't come to the tent. They turn around and they go back to report to Korah. Sorry, we weren't able to get On to come. By the time they go back, the day's over. Korah's dead. Everybody else is dead. On Ben Pelet wakes up the next morning with a heavy heart and a heavy headache, a 5 Excedrin headache from his hangover. And guess what? He lives because of his wife. Remarkable. Remarkable. So that just illustrates insight and reasoning that women uniquely have that men lack. And I mention it because it's right in our parsha from last week. What about this week's Torah reading? We have Chukat. We have the story of the mysterious red heifer. Embedded in the story is the death of one of the greatest heroines of all time. Someone, and I'm not exaggerating, if this lady didn't live, And if she didn't do what she did with her incredible sixth sense, we would not be gathered here tonight having a class. There would be no Jewish people. You might say, come on, hyperbole. No. Beli guzma, this is not hyperbole. We talk, of course, of Miriam Hanavia, the prophetess Miriam, sister of Moses and Aaron. She passes away in our parsha coming up in Chukat. And because she passes away, the miraculous Poland Springs water supply that followed the Jewish people during their journey through the desert, it went away. And that's when, unfortunately, Moses hit the rock as a desire to bring forth water to supply the rabble who were complaining about the lack of water. So Miriam dies in our parsha. They even sing a song to the well, which is a song sort of an ode to how great Miriam was. So she passes away. So Miriam is the quintessential sixth sense young lady. But before I get to the story of Miriam, I want to get to source number two. I give you a little bit of a foreshadowing where we're going to go tonight. But before we get to Miriam, let's get to source two. The Talmud tells us, in the merit of the righteous women, our ancestors were redeemed from Egypt. Wow. That means there's no Exodus. There's no future for the Jewish people without the ladies and the sixth sense. Well, where do the women of Egypt get their sixth sense? So very quickly, let's just go backwards to the original model of all Jewish women. If you are a Jew of choice, she's your mother. She's our mother, whether you're a Jew of choice or a Jew of birth. We speak, of course, of Sarah. And when does it begin with Sarah? Sarah's kind of like an adjunct to Abraham when you first meet her. She's sort of coming along with Abraham on his travels. But then there's one specific moment where Sarah steps up and God validates Sarah's position. And I always joke, that's the end of the Torah of the supremacy of men. The women take over. What is the event? Whether or not Yishmael, big brother to Sarah and Abraham's precious Isaac, should be allowed to remain in the family unit. She, Sarah, sees something very unholy, that Ishmael is a bad guy. He's like putting apples on the head of Isaac and playing little games, shooting arrows. Oh, I'm not trying to injure the prized son of Abraham and Sarah. So she sees what's going on, and she right away uses her sixth sense. You got to get rid of this guy, Ishmael and Hagar. They got to go. So she goes to Abraham. She says, Avraham, please. Garesha tamahazat vepana. You got to drive away Hagar and Ishmael, your firstborn son. They can't be with our beloved Isaac. He's not going to survive. Now, Abraham is horrified. Think about it. He is Mr. Chesed, kindness. So this is antithetical to everything that Abraham has been living his whole life about. Yeah? So he's like mortified. How can I do this? My own son, I should drive. I know he has issues. But to throw him out of the house to protect Isaac? Wow. And then God comes to Abraham and says, do you remember what Sarah just told you? Shema Bikola. Listen and heed her voice. Get rid of Ishmael. You have my approbation. So that's the end of the men dominating. I mean, we may think we're like in charge, but it's the ladies. So you skip a generation, Sarah, and you get to my personal favorite of the four mothers. Rebecca, Rivka. So here we have this young lady who marries Isaac, and 20 years they don't have a child. So finally they get Jacob and unfortunately Esau. They get the twins. And Rebecca is told up front, hey, Jacob is ultimately going to be the one. It's not going to be Esau who is Israel. It's going to be through Jacob. So she's given this inside information from a Navi, from a prophet. And the prophet is Shem, the son of Noah, identified as Melchizedek. And she, Rebecca, can't tell Isaac about it. For whatever, it's her prophetic vision. So she goes to Jacob when he grows up because she hears that Isaac, who's blind and confined to his tent, is ready to bless his firstborn, Esau. And she can't have this because she's already been told it's going to be Jacob, not Esau. And she knows who Esau is. Esau has no relationship with her. She loves him, but it's a one-way street. So Rebecca, who came from a place of Rama'ut, we are told, of ultimate deception and chicanery. Her father was the ultimate con guy, and her brother, Lavan. You look up the word con artist, David Mamet's name's there, because all his movies are about con artists, and you have the picture of Laban right there, yeah? So Rebecca goes to Jacob, says, Jacob, come here. I want you to go to dad dressed up as your big brother, Esau, and get the blessing. Again, poor Jacob is blown away. He's horrified because he's Emet. He's Mr. Truth. How can I dress up and deceive my father? And go do it, says Mom Rebecca. And then the best motherhood words ever uttered in the history of the world. You ready? But what if dad, ulai yemusheni avi? What if he gets suspicious and touches me and I'm not furry like Esau with the hair, but I'm smooth skin? And then the ruse is up, the gig is up. He knows that I'm Jacob and he curses me instead of giving me a blessing. What then, Mom? Mom says, it's okay. Go. Listen to her words. Alai kidilatecha bini. Your curse is my curse. I accept the curse. Just do what I say. I mean, it's so profound. It's so powerful. So exactly what Jacob does. He goes in. We know the story. He is found out sort of after the fact. Isaac is very suspicious, gives him the blessing. And we know that Rebecca forever changes the nature of who is a Jew. It becomes Jacob. It wasn't decided who is Israel until this moment. Yeah? Later on, he gets the formality of the angel giving him the name Israel, but that's only after this moment. So in the moment, Rebecca defines who the Jewish people were. It has to be Jacob, not Esau. Just like Sarah delineated between Ishmael and Isaac, who should be the second of the forefathers. Yeah? So it's an amazing thing, all through the ladies of our lives. Then you skip a generation, Rachel and Leah, right? I won't go through this all in detail because we're running out of time. I want to get to the real essence of Miriam. But suffice it to say that Jacob gets four wives. Two of them, Leah and Rachel, they define everything. They're saying, okay, it's my night to have a child. Sleep in my night. And every name of every child, which are definitive of the attributes of each child, who names them? It wasn't Jacob. It was Leah or Rachel. They're literally ordaining the future of the 12 tribes of Israel, what it will be to be a Jew and what specific midot attributes a Jew has to have. So Judah, the fourth son, Leah says, I love God and I'm so grateful. We call him Judah, which is Jew, because we have gratitude to God. So it's literally defined by Rachel and Leah. Okay. What about this quote that we had in source 2? The righteous women, who are they? Okay. Now we get down to Egypt land. Pharaoh has a plan, right? Enslave the Jews, they'll give up hope. If that doesn't work, we throw the babies into the water. Yeah? Did it work? Oh, yeah. But it only worked 50% because the women were never broken. The men gave up a hope for the future. So what happened with the women? Who would have a child in the insane upside-down world of Mitzrayim, of Egypt? Nobody wanted to have a child. So the poor men would come back at the end of a long day, and they were fatigued, and they were just, they had no future. They couldn't see beyond their moment of sweat and anguish. There's no future here. They would be met by these righteous women. We don't even know all their names. They're just anonymous women. And they would come out to the field, and they would beautify themselves. They would bring a delicious little picnic dinner with them, and they would meet their husbands under the stars. And they would bring a copper mirror with them. And after their husband ate and they had something to drink and he felt more human, they would play a little game of who's more beautiful, who's prettier. And they would essentially seduce their husbands in a nice, delicious way for Torah, for God. And they would have children. They would procreate, pru revu, and they would carry on having children. Now, that is not a small issue. You know how big an issue this is? Those mirrors that the women used were gifted by those women to God's home, the tabernacle, the Mishkan. And Moses was horrified. He said, wait a minute. I love the fact that conceptually the women used the copper mirrors to carry on the Jewish people's legacy. That's great. I love it. Bravo. But to include these mirrors, which had a lascivious intent as part of God's home, that's not appropriate. He didn't want to accept them. Hashem says, God says, You see, it's always God coming to the defense of the women, right? Moses doesn't see it. He's reluctant. We're not criticizing Moses, but he doesn't see it. God says, Moses, accept them. But more than that, all the gifts that you got are garnish. They're nothing compared to these mirrors. So not only must you accept everyone, but there's no measurement. The laver, depending on how you pronounce it, whether you're a fan of the great Australian tennis player, Rod Laver, if the laver, the kior, was the wash basin that the Kohanim, the priests, used to use in the temple before their service, right? It had to be every copper mirror made up that, and it wasn't allowed to be melted down and changed. It had to be in its original form to remember the heroism of those women. And those are the women alluded to in source 2, the righteous women, the Nashim Tzikoniot. So amazing. They were included with the mirrors because those mirrors represented and were more dear to God, because the women saw a future when the men couldn't see a future. That's the whole point. That's the sixth sense. We'll come to this in a minute, okay? Now, who is the greatest of the Nashim Tzikoniot? Has to be Miriam, right? How do I know this? Because it says, look at source number 3. Miriam the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took a timbrel, the drums in her hand, a tambourine, and all the women came out after her with timbrels and with dances. So when did Miriam become a prophetess? She's like 5 years old. 5-year-old little girl, little Pitzlach, right? And what has gone on? The edict of Pharaoh, Hayaora Tashrichuhu, every male child, throw him into the Nile, to the crocodiles. So what do the men do? They all divorce their wives. They give up hope. So Pharaoh knew the mind of a man, because he's a guy. But he always underestimated our ladies. And the ladies defied his edict. Better than that, they undermined him in the most profound way possible. So little Miriam, she's 5 years old. She goes to her father. Now, her father was not an ordinary guy. His name was Amram, and he was the de facto head rabbi of the Jewish people of the land of Egypt. She goes to dad. She says, Dad, you're worse than Pharaoh. You're worse than Hitler. It's a 5-year-old girl. Dad says, what do you mean, dear? He doesn't slug her or slap her. He just says, what do you mean? Well, you know, Pharaoh only is killing 50% of the Jews because he's killing the baby boys. By you divorcing mom and all the other men following suit, you're exterminating 100% of the Jews. So you're worse than he is. To his credit, incredible credit, Amram listens to his little Pitzala daughter. And he remarries mom publicly. All the other Jewish men follow after the example of Amram. And 6 months later, Moses is born. Wow. Okay. Miriam is not done. So when they can't hide baby Moses anymore, they hide him for 3 months successfully, they put him in the famous basket, and they bring him down to the Nile River. It's a whole bunch here, a lot of story, but I'm not going to go there. She puts him in the water, and then where is Miriam? She's like watching adjacent to the water, her little brother, who's very much in peril at this moment. But Miriam doesn't worry, because she knows that God is going to take care of him. She just wants to see, how is the rescue, how is the redemption of baby brother Moses, how will it be realized? I want to see this with my own eyes. So she's waiting there for hours while the basket's kind of floating. And then comes the most amazing woman in all of Egypt who's not a Jewish woman. Her name was Batya, daughter of, you want to guess? Hitler, Pharaoh's daughter, comes to the water to bathe, because she had like a leprosy psoriasis type skin disease. So she used to bathe in the Nile every day. So she comes with her maidens. She sees the basket. It's identifiable by the weave of the blanket that's protecting little Moses. And she knows he's a Hebrew boy. So that she gets it. She reaches out and brings the basket at great risk to herself. And she sees it's a crying baby. And of course, Miriam comes down and talks to the princess. And the princess says, well, I want to adopt this little girl. But she realizes that the baby won't nurse from her because she's not Jewish at that moment. She becomes Jewish later. And a whole part of heaven is named after this remarkable woman, the daughter of Pharaoh. Can you imagine defying her own dad? So she gives the baby to Miriam's and Moses' actual mom, Yocheved. She takes and nurses him for 2 years, brings him back, and he's brought up as the prince of Egypt. You know the rest of the story. This is all Miriam, right? She's, in other words, it's not like, oh, well, I guess God is going to just kill my little brother. No, it's like, I know it's going to happen. I'm 100% certain, but I can't quantify how exactly my little baby brother is going to get through this. So it's amazing. So little Miriam grows up to become Miriam the prophetess. She prophesizes about her brother's ascension to Moses' status. And that's how she becomes a Navi, because she already had the vision of who Moses would be. So when the Jewish people leave Egypt, it's the day after, the morning after the first Passover Seder, yeah? And we got to get out of Egypt. Everyone's like, come on, come on, come on, hurry up. Load up the camels, right? They didn't have a lot of time because Pharaoh's going to change his mind, which he did just a few days later. We got to go. Come on, come on. And they're jettisoning any of their little peklach, their stuff they have. They're throwing away their CD collection and all the old vinyl and the books. They can't take it with them, right? And the women, though, they're packing up the timbrels and the drums kits. So I wasn't there. But being a guy, I know that the following dialogue happened. You ready? Dear, yes, husband, we're throwing away like 95% of our possessions. We're leaving them just behind because we have no time. Why are you taking time to pack up the timbrels, the drums? And my favorite response is, I don't know. You don't know. Well, I mean, I do know that there's going to be a time somewhere in the future where I am going to bless myself and God, and I need the drums for that moment. Whenever that moment in time will be. I don't know when. I can't tell you. So you can imagine the poor husband's like, you know, but okay, fine. All right, they get to the sea. The sea splits. They get to the other side. Oz Yashir Moshe. Moses leads the man in the beautiful song of the sea. And then it tells us in source number 3, Miriam, the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took a timbrel in her hand, and all the women came out after her with timbrels and dances. Number 4, Rashi, commentary, with timbrels and with dances. The righteous women of that generation were so certain that the Holy One, blessed is He, would perform miracles for them, they took timbrels out of Egypt. This is the sixth sense. Meaning, I don't know how it's going to manifest itself, but I know that I need to pack the drums and the tambourines because it's going to be significant in the future. If you ask me to quantify it for you with logic and linear thinking, I can't do that. That is the sixth sense. It's an amazing idea. So my Rosh Yeshiva, my Rebbe, Rabbi Weinberg, has a great mashal, a great sort of metaphor to understand this, okay? So I hope that everyone knows a little bit about the magic game of chess. It's one of the greatest games ever created. If you're Russian, it's really a great game, right? So imagine for a moment that you were sitting next to the master himself, Garry Kasparov, when he played Anatoly Karpov in 3 of the most famous chess matches in history, okay? Now, you know, if you know a little bit about chess, you know that these guys are like off the charts brilliant. They have already in their minds millions and millions of permutations in games they played and movements and things. Okay, so pretend you're sitting next to Kasparov, who is like half Jewish. I'm not really sure which part, but he's half Jewish. And you're sitting right next to him, okay? And he makes a move. He moves his pawn on the 13th move of the game. He moves his pawn one place. So you say, excuse me, Garry. Yeah? Why did you make that move? Why did I make the move? Why did I make the move? That's a great question. I can't explain it to you. If you give me till next Tuesday, maybe I could work through all the permutations of possibilities of the next 35 moves that we are going to share, Karpov and I. But I happen to know that if I don't move that pawn to that place now, in 16 moves is checkmate. I'm done. That, my friends, that is what sixth sense is. You can't quantify it. But it's real. It's right there. So what do the ladies do? They don't get bogged down in the particulars of the journey. So in other words, the road may go right, left. It goes a little askew. That's not an issue. They look at the shoresh, at the goal, where they're going to go. How you get there? Okay, no, it'll be what it'll be. How is Moses going to get saved? How are we going to get through this? I don't know. You're having a child in Egypt? For what? I don't know, but we have to have children. That's the whole point, is that it doesn't have to be an objective, observable reality that is seichotic, that is logical and right in front of you. Because if that's how you approach it, then you're not going to go anywhere. But if you look at the goal, that pawn you just moved means that in X amount of moves, you won't get a checkmate. You'll win the game. Now, I can't explain it to you. I can't. How could I? It's impossible. But yet it's very true. This is the sixth sense that the ladies share. So we live in a world right now of darkness, upheaval, and Baruch Hashem, things have really changed in the last, shall we say, couple months, beginning with the Hezbollah pagers and then with the 12-day war in Iran. So we see light. But it's not over. And we know it's not over. There's a lot of bad guys hiding in the weeds and are observable and not observable. So I can't tell you how the end game is going to go in terms of the particulars. But I suspect that the women of our lives are going to play an integral role in getting to that ultimate redemption. You might say, how do you know? Because every redemption we ever had was through a woman. Think about it. Egypt was the first exile. We were in prison there. And it was the women who brought us up. Yeah? Okay. We get to the promised land of Israel. You probably know about the story of Purim. It was all Esther. You know about the story of Hanukkah. A lady named Judith, Yehudit, was, again, over and over and over again. Whenever we needed salvation, it was always a woman who showed the direction of how to go. And again, it's mysterious. It may be mysterious to you. You may be someone who has this extrasensory sixth sense. And it's impossible to quantify, but that doesn't make it any less real. So my hope and prayer for all of us here tonight is that we continue to emulate the forefathers. Meaning, it's okay to be like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and be a little shell-shocked. Like, okay, just do it? Yes. But remember, yes. If they tell you to do it, if they tell you that's the direction you have to go, that's the direction we have to go. And with God's help and with this special little sixth sense that the ladies will supply, that shoresh, that ultimate redemption will be realized in our days. B'meirah, b'yameinu, very soon.